then briefly, I just want to talk about other plans to engage other groups. And the bottom bullet's important. Again, if there's folks who are interested in hearing from us, we certainly are not excluding anybody. Yes, ma'am.
Chief, what I said, Catherine Development of Disabilities. I recommend working with the California State Council on Developmental Disabilities for this work.
Thank you. We'll be happy to set up some time to chat with the council.
Thank you.
So a couple things that we know we need to do is work with ARCA, and I made a presentation to them very similar to what you're seeing today, and then we had a very brief follow-up conversation as well. And certainly there's going to be some more in-depth conversations, as I mentioned just a moment ago, to understand what some of the service differences is first and foremost in our mind in terms of how the same service code varies from regional center to regional center. And then we'll have similar meetings with them as what I proposed here with this group as well. So provider survey will be at least discussed with them because they're probably going to be getting questions from some of their vendors when it goes out. We want to make sure they're aware of what it is we're doing. Draft rate models we'll get a presentation on, and then the public comment results as well. Provider associations that we're happy to work with as well, so presentation of the draft rate models when we get to that stage, and obviously presentation as well of the presentations as well on the public comment results. And then other groups, council, anyone else who's interested in hearing from us or sharing your input in terms of what you think is important for us to consider as we're doing these rates, we're happy to have those conversations as well. So Nancy asked me to do about an hour. I'm at an hour and 26 minutes, and I spoke about as quickly as I possibly can. Certainly, I appreciate all the questions I got, and I know if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Yeah, what I'd like to do is if we can limit, because we have a little bit more, we'll just do a little intermission break. We'll go ahead, because I don't want to stop the conversation. I think having the chance for you to ask a question. So let's take about 15 minutes, if that seems adequate, to have some question and answer. And then what I'd like to do is I do want to have a high-level discussion or discussion regarding the community development funds, and then I have an idea as far as how to pull a smaller work group together, say another week. I want to propose a couple of thoughts to you and then regroup as a task force in January. So, because we still have quite a bit more to go through, and I want to make sure that we give the time that each one deserves. So, what we'll do, are you guys okay with doing about 15 minutes of Q&A with on the rates, and then have kind of a planning discussion as far as what we're doing next? You guys feeling okay with that?
Will there be time for public comment, though?
Yeah, I'm going to make sure that we do that as well. Yeah. And as far as, and then just to jump to, because Stephen had shared as far as the work group, as you guys are giving some input, I'd also like you guys to give your thoughts as to, because we have a rate work group of the DF Task Force, and I want to get your reaction and thoughts to using that as the core group that would work with Burns and Associates on an ongoing basis. But then to make sure we have a broad representation, allowing some additional participants to be added to that work group so we can make sure that we have more. That's not going to be the only group that's going to have opportunities for dialogue with Burns and Associates, but we do need a core group that we can work with. So if you have some initial thoughts about that, that's kind of where seems to make sense to me, but I'd like your reactions to it as well. So let's take 10-15 minutes, and we'll absolutely open it up for public questions as well. So, Stephen?
Christine Moll, hello. This is very quick. You mentioned in one of your slides when you were talking about the data you were going to gather with the providers, you mentioned what I consider to be the dreaded A word, which is average. So I'm assuming that you're going to be giving statistics that are, you know, like a range and a median as well as an average, which kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. So ordinarily, depending upon the state's desire, we can provide the range of responses, right? So for wages, we typically provide this is the minimum wage reported to us for a given service, and this is the maximum. Then we ordinarily provide the average defined as the mean, the median.
Right.
We do that with and without weighting. because, again, every provider is important, but if a provider is employing 1,000 people, it might make sense to weight them more heavily than a provider who employs 2 people because they obviously are a bigger part of the marketplace. But we want to show the averages with and without that sort of weighting. And then we also show those calculations with and without what we call outliers. And we typically define an outlier as 2 standard deviations from the mean. But again, we provide all the information. Providers have every one of those numbers to look at. There's ones that we look at with more rigor than others, but we provide as many different slices of the data as folks want to see. Yes, sir.
First of all, I'd like to comment on the work you did in Mississippi. I like it, 40%. We'll take it.
UCP has done pretty well in Georgia, too.
Okay. When you do your rate studies, do you have a number or a percentage for retained earnings or profit so a provider might want to be able to expand to serve more people or maybe to deferred maintenance on real estate?
So question I actually was asked over the lunch hour as well. If you look at any of the rate models we've done for HCBS, the answer is no. You're not going to find a line item for retained earnings, profit, or any sort of other surplus. That's not saying that we have any philosophical opposition to doing it. What we've found is that becomes an easy target, right? So when it comes time to providing funding for whatever it is we're proposing, we say that there's a profit margin in there, policymakers oftentimes zero that out. But again, you know, that really is more, that's not a rate setting decision as much as it is a policy decision, right? And again, you can find myriad examples of contracts with different levels of government that include profits built into it. Even when we're talking about managed care contracts oftentimes, in Arizona, we're effectively an all managed care state. Most MCOs have risk corridors of 1.5% or 2%. So if they make more than 1.5% profit, that gets peeled back. If they have more than 1.5% loss, the state makes them whole. As was pointed out on lunch, there's federal contracts that have profit margins built in. So again, it's not a philosophical perspective on our part. It's based upon conversations we've had with the states. And to this point, we've not had a state say that we want to identify a specific profit margin in there. The other point that I emphasize is I mentioned earlier that we don't believe that our assumptions ought to be treated as prescriptions or mandatory, right? So if we put 15% in for administration and you're able to operate more efficiently than 15%, it's not as if there's a mechanism for the state to say you have to pay that back to us, and that would become effectively your profit, right? It would be built into your ability to operate more efficiently than what we've built into the rate models. Yes, sir.
Dana Hooper, we've talked about the cost of the facility. Do you bake depreciation in as a surrogate for the long-term costs of maintaining that facility?
Are you talking about a specific type of facility or?
No, a simple depreciation. Let's just say we're talking about a $1 million home.
So oftentimes, more often than not, we're not considering the cost of residential space in our rates because, as you know, that's not a Medicaid coverable service, right? Medicaid doesn't pay the room and board expenses. Now, we are looking at that here in California because people's SSI is not sufficient for us to cover the cost of room and board for a high-cost property. So, yeah, I mean, we would have to take a look at how we want to fund that, and I think depreciation is going to be, you know, part of that conversation. When we do facility space for day programs, we typically are a little less precise than that. We just say this is the average cost per square footage, which is incorporate for those who own and are depreciating versus those who are leasing and, you know, paying a rental cost.
Yeah, I guess I was specifically referring to in residential homes where the cost of the room, food, support, everything is all bundled together in one rate. And so obviously the cost on a cost-based rate model should reflect the cost of delivering those services, which include individuals staying in a room.
I think it's a conversation that we're certainly going to have. And again, I mean, in addition to all the costs that you've outlined, the thing that I hear from providers is what about damage to the property as well, right? Particularly if we're talking about folks with behavioral needs, or there might be a lot more maintenance associated with those homes than folks that are relatively less needy. So I'm not here to make any commitments today, but I understand the issue that you're bringing up, and I think it's a conversation that we're going to need to have as we're walking through this rate project.
Steven?
I'd like to actually ask if any of the task force members on the phone have any questions, and then we'll go to you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your phone keypad. That's star 1.
Specific to the task force members, I think we have 3 task force members on the phone, and then we'll go to public comment in about 5-10 minutes.
Okay. And you will hear a tone indicating that you've been placed in queue. You may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question for the phone lines, please press star 1.
Okay. So Heather, Lori, Fernando, I think you are the 3 that are on. If you don't have anything, then so I have 2 more questions, I think, from the task force, and then we'll go to public comment. So Will?
My comment was related to discussion of the use of service codes. I think you should probably involve at least some providers who do those varying service codes, especially some of our odd ones, such as Tailored Day Service, because they're not used consistently. We may have a different perspective than our brothers and sisters in the regional centers as to why those are not necessarily used as much.
Okay. We have a couple that are in the audience, and then what we'll do is go to the phone.
A couple people.
Do we have a microphone? Come on up. Don't be shy.
I'm really shy.
Not possible.
Oh, sorry, because she's already slandering me. Okay.
Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Kevin. My name is Kevin Rath. I'm from Modest Home Care and California Respite Association. I have a question about administrative rates. Have you picked a administrative rate? Is it uniform? And why or why not is it uniform across all service codes?
So the answer is no, we don't have a uniform rate that we've used in every single state. I would say in recent years, the admin rate that we've used has varied between 12 and 20%. As an aside, one of the things that I will point out that I didn't get into in this presentation is that for a variety of reasons, rate setting has become a much bigger focus of CMS. They have hired a consultant to review 1915C waiver applications, at least, and the rate setting methodologies they are in, and their requests for additional information become a lot more detailed around rates. And I bring that up only because I can tell you that's the area that CMS seems to focus on more than anything else. And what they have pushed back on me on is any time that we proposed administrative rates above 15%. I've explained to them that they're using institutions as their basis of comparison, and an institution has a much larger cost base, so 15% of $100 million generates a lot more than 15% of $1 million. And so I was able to win that argument with them, but I will tell you that there's a lot of scrutiny from the CMS perspective on administrative rates.
And I have one question.
Flip of my lead. Come on. I'm going to submit that as a, that's an unanticipated rate increase, okay? I have. Okay. 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 So, sorry. This is my last question. Will you consider similar market prices for market rate services as a control check or as a principle for determining the rates, for example, nursing services inside DDS, nursing services outside, child care inside, child care outside, supported living, which would be live-in care, outside, or, you know, daycare, certain different types of care. There's market services in the California marketplace for almost every service that we provide. And then, obviously, the stuff that we do is usually more difficult and more costly than outside the market. So are you planning to use market rates in California as a control check and or as a principle for determining our rates?
So consistent with kind of the conversation we had at CDSA, if there are specific things that you think we ought to consider, we're happy to do that. I will tell you, for the most part, those rates that are determined currently on a usual and customary basis are largely not part of our scope of work. So those that have that corollary are typically not the services that we're going to be taking a look at. And then outside of that, yes, one of the other things that we've been tasked with doing is not exactly, I think, what you're looking for, but we're happy to expand that definition, is looking for comparable services maybe across other Medicaid systems within the states and maybe other IDD programs in other states. Obviously, no one's exactly like California, but certainly we are looking at that as well. And if there's other suggestions that you have in particular that you think ought to be a basis comparison, we're certainly happy to do that as well. But again, I mean, I don't think they're going to dictate our rates, but it is something that I think is a valuable reality check.
Sorry about that. Barry Giardini, California Disability Services Association. Good to see you again, Stephen. My question is about wages in particular, because it's such a high factor in the cost of doing services, of course. You know, in reference to how you calculate the rates, you know, with the example you've given on nursing, nurse wages are fairly standardized. There's an itemized item on the BLS, for example, and you've used the BLS actually as an example as a published source that we might use. But there is no identifier for direct service professionals in the BLS data. So with that and with our escalating state minimum wage costs and local minimum wage costs, I'm just curious, what sort of factors are we looking at in determining, you know, what an adequate wage is in an area?
Sure. So I'm sorry, with an abbreviated time I had today, I didn't go through the full-blown rate packet. So I could have used an actual example because for how we've done DSPs, for example, in Hawaii or Virginia, another state that we've worked in. As a starting proposition, we typically do rely on the BLS. As you pointed out, there is no specific what they call SOC or standard occupational classification for direct support professionals. Currently, all those folks are lumped into the personal care aide, which I think is 39-90-21 under the BLS data. At the CDSA conference, I know Esme from ANCOR indicated that they're working with BLS to try to get a new employment classification established in the BLS, but that's not going to help us in the time that we have for this rate study. So working with the data that we have available to us, we've long recognized that just using the personal care aide is inadequate to reflect the demands in a DSP, right? Because that includes a variety of other occupations who, frankly, are doing less hard work than what DSPs are doing. So what we have done elsewhere is we use that as one factor in our wage buildup, but we also look at other occupations as well. So we look at the requirements of those staff, and then we look at other BLS occupations that have some of those same requirements, and we end up doing a weighted average, right? So we might use the personal care aide for 50% of the wage, but then we'll use the psychiatric technician, or we'll use the nursing assistant, or we'll use the recreation assistant, or we'll use a social worker position, and we'll effectively do a buildup of the other responsibilities that they have. Now, when we move away from a specific occupation like registered nurses, there's not a whole lot of room for disagreement, right? That is what BLS says it is, at least. For DSP, it's going to be our assumptions, and then we're going to have conversations about whether or not you think our assumptions are reasonable in terms of what their various responsibilities are. So that's what we typically use from an independent source. We also take a look at what's reported to us on the provider survey to see what providers are currently paying. But again, one of the points I often make in these presentations but omitted today is a big part of the reason that we don't rely only on provider cost data is because that is indicative more than anything else of how much you're being paid today, right? And if your rates aren't sufficient, your costs are going to be depressed. And where we see cost depression more than anything else is in the frontline workforce because that's your number one expense as an HCBS provider. It's not like when we do hospital rates. The cost of operating a hospital has very little to do with how much you pay your doctors and your nurses. It has to do with your building and all the very expensive equipment that you have. But when we're talking about HCBS, that's the majority of your cost is the wages. So if your rates are too low, it means you're going to have to take that out of your biggest cost item, which is how much you pay your staff and what benefit package is available to them. So by relying on other information like the BLS, we're getting what we think is a better representation of what the adequacy of a wage would be. The other point I'll make on minimum wage is that's becoming an issue that's emerging more and more across the country, right? I mean, the whole issue of local minimum wages or even statewide minimum wages is not unique to California. So it's something that we've given a lot of thought to in terms of how we want to handle it. Obviously, we don't want to build rates that reflect a wage less than what you're legally obligated to pay. But then after that, there really is a policy conversation to be had about what sort of premium potentially above the minimum wage should we be building into these rate models? Because if we're only paying the minimum wage, we're competing with fast food and retail, and that work is not as demanding as working with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And if I was going to stock, I use this example at lunchtime, I use it in other conferences. If I had a choice between stocking shelves at Target or working in a group home with people with severe disabilities, I'm going to stock shelves at Target because it's easier work. So then it becomes a conversation of, if we don't want to, you know, only get the people who can't get the retail and the fast food jobs, what does that look like? Again, that becomes a conversation that's going to be not just me making decisions. It's going to be a broad conversation, you know, with you, with DDS, and with others as well. But it's something that we're certainly cognizant of, because when you look at the rates, 60 to 75% of the total cost is going to be how much we're putting into the wages and benefits of the frontline workforce.
So we have a couple people that are on the phone for public comment. Yep. So I'm going to go ahead. We'll come back. So we have Connie Boyer Frenzel from the Autism Society. You have a question? Operator, can you assist us?
Yes. I'm going to open up the line for Connie Boyer Frenzel. Please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you, Connie.
Okay. Yes, I'm a parent of a 30-year-old with autism needing 24/7 care, and we live in the most expensive cost of living area in the entire nation. One of the questions I'm wondering if you're going to explore is, in terms of, I think it's great what you're doing, but I'm concerned that the legislators, their political will they actually fund it once they know, you know, have the data? And one of the things that's happened has been there's been a lot of unused funds being returned to the state. The providers, you can't find them, and so even though the regional center may have authorized this service to be funded, it doesn't happen. Then the money is returned back to DDS, which then goes back to the general fund, is my understanding. My comment is I think we should explore the actual data, how much money is being returned and why, because that may be a talking point to sort of back up your rate study. And I'm not sure if that's within your scope, but that's something I think we need to explore. The second question I have is, will you be exploring the impact of other systems that are out of DDS, for example, in-home support services, which helps pay for the residential supported living? Because they're in a different system, and what's happening currently is that they may have one rate in the county, say $13 an hour, where the supported living part of it is at 14 or 15. And so because of trailer bill language, we're mandated to use a large amount of these IHSS hours. That can affect the budget of providers. So I'm wondering if you're going to be looking at the other programs that support regional center funding and the rates, because that could be a really big issue.
Thank you, Connie. So, Stephen, I think part of the question, the input, and we'll make sure that we add this to our list of input regarding the amount of funds that are not used that by regional centers that's allocated each year. So we'll add that to our input list. But anything further than what you've already shared regarding looking at outside comparisons, Stephen? So.
Connie, this is John Doyle with the department. The issue that you raise of the rates that are currently paid for IHSS compared to what is paid for supported living is an issue that, you know, we've heard a lot of different perspectives on that, but as part of the survey, we're not looking at modifying, or as part of the rate study, we're not looking at modifying IHSS rates. Those are that's beyond the purview of this rate study that we're doing. And like I said, we do understand the issue that you brought up, but this is not you know, we don't have responsibility over IHSS rates, and so that's not going to be part of this study.
Okay, I'm just saying that it does impact the ability to find direct service professionals when you may have someone with 270 hours that they have to use first through IHSS, and then they go over to DDS, and so you can't do the program because you can't hire people on the IHSS rates. So I think we need to address this somehow. Anyway, that's my comment.
And understand that the concern is particularly the problem is particularly highlighted in high-cost areas, just the one you live in, the high-cost areas of the state. And we know
I mean, we have people, providers going out of business because they can't meet the minimum wage requirements that the city may have passed or the county. And so I think that I think you said you were going to address that too, where the cities set up a minimum wage and yet the providers aren't getting enough funds from the state.
Yeah, and thank you, Connie, for, you know, there's always a number of opportunities for not only within our rate study, but certainly IHS says to hear what the concerns are. And we'll continue to take a look at the high-cost areas that Stephen had shared and looking globally as to when we're taking a look at our rate study. And we'll continue to take that feedback. So thank you for sharing. We also had another person on the phone, Sharon Francis, service provider. And then we have a couple of folks here. And I apologize, I'm only going to take a few more questions, but we'll make sure we have future opportunity. Sharon, operator, can you assist us with Sharon Francis?
Yes. Sharon, your line is open.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to comment and ask questions. I'm a service provider. I do respite care, an independent living in Ventura County. I'm a board member of the Autism Society Ventura County California Respite Association and my regional center vendor representative at Tri-Counties. The comment or questions that I had were related to daycare, and you may not have the answers now, but I just wanted to put a little bug in your ears for families, and that's just that the median rates that we've all been living under for so many years now, especially in certain regional center areas, regardless of high cost living, has just really hurt many of the families when it comes to properly funding daycare. The regional center that our families have, and to no fault of their own, this is just how all the regional centers have had to operate, has had extremely low daycare rates because when they were set, that's just what it was years ago. So families, like just right over the border, it's just a huge difference. So in our area, it's been around $3.50 an hour, whereas just on the other side of the city, they get like $12 an hour to support families. And because the Family Cost Participation Program, which I don't think is going away anytime soon, unfortunately, it's just added injury to insult because they have their, you know, daycare funding cut for that. So the question that I have for you is just, you know, are daycare rates going to be included in this study, and will families be asked to submit their cost data?
If that's included. Yeah. Stephen, do you remember?
So at this point, and one of the things that we'll do the next time we get together is give you the final list of what service codes we are having in the scope of work and what we do not. At the moment, I believe that's the 450 and 455 are not part of our charge.
But we'll thank you for the input. What we'll do is we'll take a look. It amazes me that Stephen knows all these service codes. And feel free to ask him any question, and he'll tell you the service code. But I do think that the benefit, Sharon, thank you for sharing that, because I think that helps us then take a look at what are the service codes that we're looking at. And the three-day meeting that was referenced, one of the things that we did is that we literally went through every single service code. And now then what we will be doing is, again, engaging the public input, and that will be our next step. So thank you for that, and we'll take a look at that.
Yeah, the last thing I would say on that is just, you know, my local legislator shares my concern, and that the feedback that we're getting is that, you know, because of the median rates, nothing can change even for this crazy low daycare rate until this rate study is done. So if the rate study is not going to address daycare, then what? So thank you.
No, thank you for your input. So we had one other from the public comment here.
Oh, hi.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I'm holding with Mr. Steele. I didn't hear you talk very much about network adequacy, so I was wondering, will you be looking at network adequacy? I've been hearing more and more providers, including within our own network and with fellow providers here, that basically we're having a really hard time being able to get services started because of the shortage in the labor market. And so I know you're looking at labor market, but also, you know, in Medicaid, network adequacy is a normal discussion that you hear on a regular basis on the other side of the insurance part.
Sure.
So could you talk about it as it applies to the DDS system?
Sure. And I do have a bullet or two in there that talks about, I think, provider sufficiency. I forget exactly what the phraseology I used in the presentation was, but that's what we're getting at. Again, without telling you exactly what might change, one of the things that we will be taking a look at, because part of the charge is looking at underserved areas. So when we've done these sorts of analysis in the past, we take a look at what proportion of the enrollment in a given area is accessing a specific service and how that compares to the statewide average. Because there's not necessarily a reason that we would expect people in a given region are more disabled or more in need of a service than people in a different region, right? So we look first, do we see enrollment rates that are comparable in each given area? And if we don't, then the question is there an explanation for it? And if not, what, if anything, do we want to do about it? In addition to just looking at pure enrollment rates, we also take a look at, for those folks who choose a service, how much do they get? Because, again, they might get a service, but they might not be getting as much. So I can give you kind of a brief anecdote about how we've taken a look at this in another state for a specific service. So when we did rate setting in New Mexico, despite some of the rate reductions we proposed, we also proposed some rather large rate increases for therapies and behavioral support consultation services. And one of the things we proposed to do was to pay higher rates outside the Albuquerque and Santa Fe areas, because those are reasonably urban areas, but then everywhere else in New Mexico is pretty rural. And so the analysis that justified that was taking a look at what proportion of folks had access to each of the three therapeutic disciplines as well as BSC. And we found, and don't quote me on the numbers because this was 6 or 7 years ago, but the statewide average was, and New Mexico is unique in a lot of ways, but like 60% of adults are getting adult therapies or BSC. Statewide. But then when we look outside Albuquerque and Santa Fe, it was 20 or 30%. And then when we looked at how much they're getting, again, within the Albuquerque and Santa Fe counties, they were getting 50 hours a year. Outside of that, they were getting 35 hours a year. And so based upon those factors, it appeared to us, and then we did some other analysis on the LLS data as well, but based upon the totality of our analysis, it appeared that there was unserved areas outside of Albuquerque and Santa Fe. So we created higher rates for what we called incentive counties that effectively was intended to incentivize providers to locate in those more rural sections. So that's the sort of analysis that we'll be taking a look at, is are people accessing services.
Have you thought about taking a look at data from the point that it ends up in the IPP to the point that you have a provider billing for it, to see how long does it take for families to actually get service?
So.
Just an interesting question.
It is, and that kind of is part and parcel with the comment. I forget who asked a little while ago about the services that are authorized and unused, and I think what Nancy said is that we'll collectively go back and we'll think about what data is available and what potentially we want to include as part of that conversation. I mean, I've done that in the past in other systems, particularly like in early intervention systems where we're looking at, you know, because the federal requirements are pretty stringent around, you know, how long between the IFSP versus service delivery, et cetera. So we've done that sort of thing before. I don't know that we've specifically had a lot of conversations to this point for this particular engagement, but we've heard your comments. We heard in earlier comments, and we'll, as Nancy said, we'll reconvene on those matters.
Okay, thank you. I think what we'll do is go ahead and move forward with a couple of other agenda items, but Stephen, thank you very much for your time. And
I should say, you have it in your handout, but that's my direct phone line, that's my email address, so certainly folks have other thoughts, questions, feel free to follow up with me, and I will get back to you as expeditiously as I can.
Thank you.
And so I hope everyone found it informative, and we're going to be getting dates out shortly for reconvening the rate work group, which is, of course, open to all task force members, as well as probably bringing on some extra folks to help with that. So we view that as sort of where the nuts and bolt work is going to get done, because it's going to have to meet more frequently. But we really look forward to your engagement on that, because we feel that's sort of the main body to get the input that we need. So that's the sort of the plan going forward to set the stage.
And just to kind of continue a little bit on that thought, we're actually looking at, I have to work with Burns and Associate on schedules, but I'm hopeful that we can actually take a look at doing that at sometime in January. Because I think we have a lot of other questions, and so we'll make sure that we do that soon. So no vacation plans, all right? A couple of things
We, again, have a number of items that are on the agenda for today, and we have just about 20 minutes left. So what I'd like to do is, because I do want to make sure that I get some high-level priorities as far as what, as input on the community development funds that we would be looking at. But then I'd also like to consider, if I can arrange it, and I'm pretty sure that I can get it scheduled, is if we're looking at, with the meeting that we have scheduled on the 20th of this month on person-centered practices and planning, that many of you are participating in that. And so one of the things we could do is have be a an hour and a half, where we the smaller work group that we have, the community development work group, those who can participate right beforehand, and spend, you know, a good hour and a half, and really talk through. So as we've moved from the closure of the developmental center to community placement plan dollars, just we're really, they're earmarking the point. The orange that got in the way. I'll move my name. So making sure that, because right now, as of 17-18 fiscal year community placement plan, all of the funds have really been earmarked to support the closure of the developmental centers. We may have a little bit left that we could look at using for community development, but as of now, we really are looking at using the remainder to support that challenging services needs in support of the closures. That said, the 18-19 guidelines for community placement plan and community development plan, we want to have those out by early part of the calendar year. So starting July 1st, 2018, that we'll be ready to go. And what we need from the input from the DS Task Force is that as we've now kind of shifting and going to the Community Development Fund, you know, when we're writing the guidelines, priorities that we're going to want to take a look at. You know, as, you know, certainly it's important to still focus on safety nets, crisis services, making sure that we're addressing the needs of individuals in a little bit more of the restrictive settings, the IMDs, et cetera. But when we're looking beyond that, you know, what are the important elements within the guidelines? And so by having some of the kind of the high level priorities that I can receive during our discussion over the next few minutes, this next 15 minutes, but also sending in comments is going to be really helpful. And then having a continued conversation later this month, because from that, we'll go ahead and draft the guidelines. And I had alluded earlier that based on the discussions, I do see a benefit of us having another task force meeting. And look at doing that. If I can get it scheduled for the end of January, that would be something that would be beneficial for all of the topics that we're working on. And then at that point, then we could have the draft guidelines to you, and we could get input back from the guidelines. So thoughts, reactions to two things. One is having another meeting at the end of January for the task force. And then the other is priorities and what we need to look at for development in the community. And again, this is just extremely high level, because at the regional centers, by statute, when we're doing the guidelines, we have to make sure what we're incorporating in the guidelines is that every regional center has to have any of their proposals that come to the department have to include what did they do to have participation and community engagement. How did they design or develop? What is informing them of those resources? I'll give you an example. If they have a number of individuals that are graduating high school and there's a need to develop employment services, you know, what is the data, what is the community involvement telling them that this is a priority and why they're needing some additional funds at the local level to develop those resources? So those are the thoughts right now. Will?
Will Sanford. I would say, right at the top, it's affordable housing support and development, especially in high-cost areas. We're losing it faster than they can make it. And the other one is, and at least our area has been a huge issue with access as far as transportation services. Paratransit has become more and more unreliable. Our fixed route or routes paid for by the regional centers have become more and more unreliable, where people are simply saying, sorry, we can't pick you up today. I mean, it's really gotten so that if we're really going to move down the road with the final rule, we're not in compliance at all because people can't actually make their choice and actually have it fulfilled. So, I mean, those are the two highest ones I know. I mean, the hard part is, I think, that unless there's also the allowance for dealing with the median rates for some of those issues, throwing startup money at that simply means I can start it, but I can't run it. So no one's going to start it.
Okay. Thank you, Will. Honey?
I don't know how to articulate this so that you can operationalize it, but I see transitional services as being so critical. When people are about to graduate or get out of school, where they are. And I just keep hearing it from families and that they're at home. They can't find the right services. And I know employment is really important, and absolutely, but transition services. And I do want to say, I think we need another meeting because we have a lot. It isn't because you didn't say self-determination, but I said it, so it's mentioned.
I am going to give a quick update. Don't worry, Connie.
No, I know. I promised you. Is that we come here and we have an opportunity. And I don't want to lose it. And it's face-to-face is always better. So I appreciate that. Just make it the 30th or 31st if it's going to be the end of January. My calendar.
That's not a person-centered.
I'm a Leo. Sorry.
That's okay. We're going to work with Connie on a person-centered plan. And
no, a behavioral plan.
Yeah. No, thank you, Connie. Additional comments for?
Yeah, I just wanted to also add to.
Kathy McCoy, GGRC. I just wanted to make an additional comment. It's important to do the transition plan, obviously, for children, young adults coming into the system, aging out of school age, but I think we also need to focus on people aging out of their residential care facilities as well, our RCFE-aged folks. We don't have a lot of capacity for that or a lot of services that actually address that population, so I don't want to forget about that.
Okay. And it's interesting. It's really consistent with the input that we've received over time is looking at, you know, the discussions that we've had at the task force, but also other community engagement discussions, talking about accessibility to housing, transportation, that transition age use to the next step, what are those services, and then also making sure that, especially with the aging population being one of the groups that is becoming a higher percentage of the total consumer population. So those are really consistent. What we can do is that I will send to also those that have participated and to everybody a potential date for the end of this month to continue some of the discussion as far as what are important elements. The statute, you have a copy of the statute for the guidelines. So there's elements that where I really want to also get some input is that what is going to be the critical piece for community engagement at the local level? What's going to be important for us to include in the guidelines when it comes to the proposals that are submitted to the department from the regional center? You know, what does that look like? And so we can have some discussions about that. Anything else related to kind of the important elements of the community development? It's such a wonderful opportunity. I don't want to shorten the time of the discussion. But we also had such rich discussions earlier today, so it was hard to fit everything in. Christine?
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but of course I want updates from you wonderful people over there as far as how the crisis centers are going and getting those in place and just basically safety net services. I would like that to be a continued topic and priority for sure.
Yeah, and that's
where for our next meeting, because we didn't get any time at all to talk about what were the guiding principles that you all collectively helped guide the discussions. So we want to spend time on that and then spend time on taking a look at the areas of discussion, you know, the different work groups. And so, you know, going forward this next year, what are those things we want to talk about? You know, have the safety net discussion, have what work groups and stuff. So that's where we're not going to ignore it. We're going to just go ahead and have DF Task Force meeting take two. You know, we'll go ahead and have part two in January to finish that piece. Okay, Connie?
I have a whole house full of studies and documents and hearings, and I want this to be a living document. I really do. We put a lot of work in it, and over time, and words meant everything. So I'm glad to hear that. I just want to say that.
Yes, definitely. So anything else in addition to the community development? And so what I do want to give an update on self-determination and HCVS real quick, and then I will open it up for additional public questions or comments on anything that we've discussed. And we won't have a lot of time for it, but like I said, we'll have an opportunity in January to open up for broader discussions as well. So self-determination, the work continues. We've had, since July, we as a department and also with Department of Healthcare Services have had technical assistance and discussions almost every month. We've had 5 calls with CMS, with federal government, to work through whatever questions that they had on the application. And so through the work, we've been able to focus on the topic areas that they've had questions or concerns about, and we have submitted our final response to their final questions, the current final questions, at the end of November. We are now scheduled for a call on January 3rd with CMS to review if there's any additional questions or follow-up that they have to the review of the application. So there's 2 things we need to focus on, is the approval of the application and then also the building of the infrastructure of the program. So once we have the approval of the application, that we're ready to go. So on the application, this is where we are right now. We've had a couple of conversations with the self-determination work group, really good discussions about what are the priorities, what are the next steps. And what we've done is we've had conversations also with Department of Healthcare Services, and we're all very committed that if CMS is looking at it from a point that they see, that we really are at a point of being able to get back on the clock with the submission of the application, that we as a department, along with DHCS, are committed to doing that by the end of January. That said, this is all dependent on the conversation that we have on January 3rd to see, you know, what are the outstanding questions. But based on all of the original, like 100, 150 questions that did come to us from the original application that was sent to CMS, we are really down just to a handful, which we've provided those responses to. Some of the questions that are still outstanding that we're waiting to hear back from CMS on is how we're handling the non-vendored services. So services that are not vendored by a regional center, how is that managed through the self-determination program? And then also incident reporting. So those are the 2 things that we've responded back, and a couple of other areas in waiting to get that feedback. So we're feeling very, very good about it. But again, we're looking forward to that conversation. We are going to circle back with the work group on January 4th or 5th as to the follow-up from that call on the 3rd. So by the end of the month in January, when we meet again as a task force, we'll be able to give you another update on that. With the informational meetings, one of the things that's really critical, we've done as a department, we did training at 5 different trainings at different regional centers for regional center service coordinators. That was across the state, but more probably equally as important was also the informational meetings, doing the train the trainer, because anybody who's going to participate, as a reminder, the first 3 years, there's 2,500 participants for self-determination. So in consumers, there's going to be 2,500. Now, of those 2,500, that has to be representative of the community throughout the state. So part of the getting on the list to be selected, there's an informational meeting. We want to make sure it's broad, that we're going out and having as much outreach as possible to the community and getting those informational meetings done. So we did a train-the-trainer where community-based organizations and regional centers can go ahead and do that, submit the names to the department. As of now, we have about 800 consumers that have been added to the list to be selected. I know there's more than that that have actually gone through the different informational trainings. I don't believe that 800 is representative of those that will be on the list. So we're going to be working with the work group and the regional centers to make sure that we as a department are getting that list so we can really make sure that we're getting the selection. We're also then working over the next several months focusing on the financial management services, independent facilitator, and then also making sure that we're doing the things that we need to as far as the training, so when the implementation's ready to go, that we're very clear on what are the next steps that have to happen for us to make sure that when we have an approved application that we're ready to go. That is the Reader's Digest version of the update. We remain very committed to it, and we'll continue to communicate and make sure that people are informed. And if we're not doing it well enough, our great work group is going to let us know that we need to communicate a little bit more. So any questions on self-determination real quick? So then home and community-based services, we have submitted the statewide transition plan. We're waiting to hear back. We have had, again, continued conversations with CMS and technical assistance on that. We are releasing the guidelines for the next $15 million that's going to be I'm trying to be as good as Brian and Jim, but, you know, I just don't have their memory. I want to give you the state because I want you to make sure that you're keeping your eyes and ears open. Susie, do you know?
January,
the
January 6th is when providers have to submit. So we sent the letter out November 1st, and January 5th is when they can submit proposals.
January 5th is the due date.
Yes. January 19th is when the regional centers need to happen to the department.
Okay, perfect. So hopefully providers are working on it. If you have questions, we have a great team that's willing to, available to answer any of the questions regarding the $15 million funding. We had over 900 proposals last time. I'm not sure how many, but we're real excited about the interest that's there, and we'll continue to work with the community on that. Any questions on, again, we will make sure that this is on the topic items for January's meeting as well. So with that, we have just a couple of minutes. I'm happy to entertain additional questions from the task force, or if there's a couple of burning questions from the public, we can certainly try to either take note of it for the next time or try to answer it. Yes?
Yeah, sure.
Deb Donovan from Valley Village. I just wanted to, there was one thing that I didn't hear addressed today, and that is the community supports for the more medically fragile and aging adults. I think we've done a good job with folks coming out of the state DCs. With the ARC push-in programs, however, for folks that are currently living in the community, we have a lot of folks that are still living in skilled nursing facilities, and also not unsupported day services for those individuals as well.
Thank you, Deb. Yeah, we'll make a note of that. Connie?
It's late, I know. I can do this in 2 seconds. I just want to clarify, and something that's very important to me, of course, seems like everything is, but it's the idea of a person-centered plan versus a person-centered planning process. And I think the way it's, when we talk about guiding principles, and we have next week to talk about it, the person-centered plan and the IPP are two different things. And I think when we merge them together, even though an IPP should be, have a person-centered planning process, it's not the same as a plan. So I think we need more clarification, and we need to, because people are confused. Of course an IPP is person-centered. It has somebody's name on it. And people try to make it that way, but they're two different things. And if we want to be successful with everybody, they need a really authentic person-centered plan first. So I just want to point that out.
And you're referring to the guiding principles for the task force, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll make sure also, in addition to next week's discussion, that we have that when we get back together in January.
I'll show you my notes, all right?
Yeah, so maybe just, so the meeting on the 20th will be to address the CPP guidelines, and then we'll come back to guiding principles in January that we had on the agenda today but didn't get to. So we want to refocus this and, you know, have the discussion on what this group's going to be and the principles and discussion topics. So we'll take note of that and circle back in January.
Okay. Terry?
Yeah, I'd just like to say we actually had a pre-meeting about this topic this morning on the plane, and so we have a lot of the work done already, and so we'll be glad to bring it back to the table in January. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And we had a unanimous opinion.
Did you?
Yes.
Did you?
The whole plane.
Well, no one defended.
I think that's great. You have a captive audience.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for your time and attention and spending the hours together. Okay. Right. So, Doug Pascover, there is a question I think, Doug, you had as well. Operator, can you assist in opening up Doug's line?
Yes, I can. Your line is now open. Hello, Mr. Pascover. Your line is now open. Can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Okay, there you go. It's open. Please go ahead.
Hi, Doug. We can hear you.
Okay. Hi, everyone. This goes back about, I think, an hour, but I just wanted to, point out that along with what both Marty and Connie said, it really is a concern that where there are people not being served, race may or may not be the problem, but you can't get the answer by asking the people who aren't serving them. And then I missed an early part, but I'm a little concerned about the extent to which the rate study seems to be focusing on inputs rather than outcomes, and that wasn't the direction that I thought we were heading, but I know there's a long process ahead, and I'll look forward to seeing that play out.
Okay, thank you, Doug. And also, because I know that part of that, when you take a look at the kind of guiding principles or the one of the elements that Burns and Associate does have outlined is talking about outcomes as well. So, but I think it's an important point, and we're going to have many opportunities to make sure that we have, it's a commitment of ours to make sure that we have a broad input and community engagement process in the rate study.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, everybody. We will get a notice out for the end of January, and have safe and happy holidays. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Yeah. This concludes our conference for today. You may now disconnect.
Thank you. Bye.